This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 263 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I've got the full complement of co-hosts this episode. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
And this weekend, I just flew by. I was privileged enough to go flying in a B-24 on Friday. And what an awesome experience that was. Thank you to the Collins Foundation and Ryan Kehoe.
Where did you ride in the airplane?
We took off. I was in the rear compartment, the gunner's compartment. And then, but once we were airborne, we could freely move about the cabin. One kind of funny story is the way the crew alerts you so you can get up and move around the cabin is they ring a bell. The difference between that bell and what's on a normal airliner is actually what they ring is the bailout bell twice. So... I got to stand up and watch them fly from the cockpit, take lots of pictures out the window, out the side gunner doors with the windows off, got to sit in the back tail turret. Overall, it was a great 45-minute flight.
I'm so envious. We'll expect to see some pictures from this little flight of yours, David.
Yep, and I did get an interview with two of the Collins Foundation pilots, the senior most pilot, who's qualified in the B-17, the B-24, their B-25, their A-1 Skyraider, their TP-51C Mustang, and a really interesting guy, as well as one of the senior pilots who was getting requalified for the B-24, but his other job is to fly a Boeing B-29 by the name of Fifi. So a couple of good interviews that we should have in our Bits and Pieces show coming up.
Oh, fantastic. All right, well, waiting patiently in the background is our other co-host, Mr. Rob Mark. Hi, Rob.
I was patient? No, I just kind of jumped right in, right on top of David there.
I sort of gave it to you.
Being patient at all. Hey, listen, it's nice out here in Chicago. I'm not going to talk about what the weather's like, though. It's just nice to be here, and I'm surviving my first week as an empty nester, having dropped my daughter off to college in Los Angeles, and... It was fine. I mean, none of us had any problem with it.
So you took a little plane ride yourself then, since the last time we talked.
Oh, yeah.
Who'd you fly on, Rob?
We went out on beautiful downtown Southwest Airlines and up and back. Of course,
good flight?
Yeah.
Good service?
Well, you know, those guys are just always nice. I mean, you know, they may have... their own issues now and again about people like us that are dressed funny, but I was always dressing funny. Of course, they've never told me I couldn't fly on the airplane because I was too sexy. I was always hoping for that one, but that just never happened.
Yeah, dream on, Rob.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
All right, well, as we mentioned last episode, we're going to go without a guest this time so that we can focus on the listener mail. We have lots of good topics. Lots of interesting things from all of you guys, and we've been sort of collecting them because we haven't been able to get to all of them each episode. So no guests this time. The main topic is you all, our listeners, and we're really excited about that. We also have a few other segments. David, an airplane of the week.
We are, and due to complaints that I don't do enough GA, we're going to do the Piper Cherokee.
All right, the Cherokee. Steve and Grant are off this week, so they don't have an Australia desk per se. Those guys have been really busy doing some traveling and getting involved in some exciting stuff, and we'll be hearing more about that, I'm sure. But no Australia desk report this week. However, and some of you listening already know this, Rob doesn't because, well, he hasn't heard the last episode. But we have a little something from the guys down under for Rob. So we'll wait for that. Also, we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. He's talking with Tim Robinson, the editor of Aerospace Magazine. Look forward to that. All right. And, of course, lots and lots of listener mail. But first, let's get started with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Our first item comes from Popular Science. This is titled, No One Wants to Be a Drone Pilot, U.S. Air Force Discovers. Well, there was some interesting data in this article that I really wasn't aware of, including the fact that about 8.5% of the U.S. Air Force pilots are drone pilots. But drone pilots quit at a rate roughly three times that of their manned aircraft pilot counterparts during flight screening. Now, the Air Force needs more drone pilots, but they can't get enough people to volunteer for training. And a lot of this information comes from a new report. This was written by an Air Force Colonel Bradley Hoagland. This is something for the Brookings Institution. That's a think tank. It's titled Manning the Next Unmanned Air Force, Developing RPA Pilots of the Future. David, what's the problem with drone pilots?
The problem is the Air Force, unbeknownst to themselves and in their wisdom, created a dead-end job. Right now, there is no path for mobility once you become a drone pilot. So if you normally you want to progress up the chain of command and you do a command thing and a command tour, and right now, once you're in drones, you're sort of in drones forever, and maybe that would be fine for some people, but there's no upward growth. And let's face it, if you're flying a Predator or a Reaper, you're not really going off to flying in airlines. The United hasn't caught up with unmanned aircraft yet.
At least not yet, right.
So really what they've created was a position that really doesn't fit the mold, and they're really not sure what to do with people. And their solution right now is the pilots are getting, if they sign up for a tour of duty, a huge, I mean, humongous signing bonus to do another tour as a drone pilot. So it's going to be interesting. It's not really, there's pilots that are pilots, and then there are drone pilots who come up from the enlisted. So it's sort of this murky area, and it's going to take a while for the Air Force to figure out how to structure it. The other prime example was they came up with a Medal of Valor for cyber warfare and drone pilots. And that caused all of the uproar with the veterans because people were getting medals for combat and they never left the comfort of Creech, Nevada. So that went away quietly as the Air Force again still struggles with what to do with their pilots. They need to come up with some sort of command and control, and it's kind of a high-stress job. I mean, flying, you may be sitting in a black box, but you are staring at monitors in high-threat areas, and you need to be alert that whole time. So it's a learning curve. I'm sure that they had these kind of issues back when the United States Navy or the Army got this new flying Air Corps stuff. What the heck are we going to do with these people? So it's just a learning curve.
I'm just having trouble with that. I really am. I can't believe that nobody thought about this. I don't know. Maybe it's me, but I mean, you would have thought that when they bring these people up, they have skills. If a lot of these folks are enlisted people, and to say that, oh well, we'll make them drone pilots and they'll be happy there forever, and no one said, you know, maybe we ought to think about that.
Well, I think part of it, Rob, would be the fact that, yes, it is kind of stupid that they didn't think of this, but this has grown exponentially over the last couple of years. This has not been, I mean, since 2001, we've quintupled the amount of drones that we have. So the technology has not caught up with the infrastructure, I guess would be the best way to say it. We've got so much technology and we need so many people to operate the technology. The infrastructure to provide that has not been made available or been properly designed.
The report says something about the number of pilots required, too, that I found pretty fascinating. It says that in the late 90s, there were about 50 people, 50 pilots for unmanned vehicles like this. And now we have over 1,300, and they're expecting a need for 1,650 by fiscal year 2017. So it's a lot of pilots for sure.
So this is interesting. So we're not going to have enough drone pilots. We're not going to have enough regional airline pilots. We don't have enough people learning to fly just to use all the airplanes that Wichita would like to sell. Sounds like we got a little problem here.
Sounds like a shortage, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The report includes some recommendations. Now, I've read portions of this report. I haven't read the whole thing cover to cover. But one thing I picked out is it seemed to be proposing that a volunteer for one pilot specialty is a volunteer for all pilot specialties. So in other words, you'd qualify pilots to be pilots, whether that's manned or unmanned, and then split people off from there, I guess. That it seems to me like an unmanned pilot is a different kind of a person than a manned pilot, but I don't know.
A manned pilot, huh?
Yeah, manned pilot.
So you know there's something coming here about womaned pilots or something, right?
There's something in there, I'm sure.
There have been all sorts of jokes over time where women crews in naval aviation would say they were an unmanned aircraft. I mean, that's so
right.
That joke's been around forever.
Yep. So finally, another recommendation that's in this report is that there needs to be a better screening of pilots. That, you know, maybe like you mentioned, David, the process has not really followed the technology, and so people are getting qualified or pre-qualified to be unmanned vehicle pilots, and then they get into the thing, and then they discover that, well, that's maybe not quite for them, and they have this high fallout rate, which of course doesn't help the problem. So, of course, we'll have a link to the article in the show notes. The article contains a link to the report, to the Brookings Institute report. It's not too difficult to read. It's not too long. So, you know, invite people to take a look at that.
Doesn't have a lot of big words.
Yeah, I think you could get through it pretty easily, Rob.
Good, good, good.
All right. One of the things we talked about two episodes ago was about AOPA and the search for a new president. And that search has actually been completed. The decision's been made, and it's been announced.
And it's not Rob Mark.
It's not Rob Mark. Rob, we proposed that.
Matt had it down pat. Matt Dutch said it wasn't going to be me, and he was right.
That's right. And it turns out that it's Mark Baker who's going to be succeeding Craig Fuller. Mark Baker is a longtime GA pilot. I guess he's got something over 7,500 hours, been flying GA for 35 years. He's also a former executive at Home Depot and Scott's Miracle-Gro. Rob, do you know this guy, Rob? Is it somebody that you're familiar with?
No, I must say I've never heard of him, although I did wonder, with his last name being Baker, I wondered if he was any relation to John Baker, who was, I believe, the first president of AOPA back in the old days. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he was the second. But there was also a Baker in there a long time ago. So I'll have to do a little digging on that one.
Now, there's been, I think five presidents of AOPA over the, almost 75-year history of the organization?
Right, and I can't think. Let's see. So Baker, Craig Fuller, Phil Boyer, John Baker, and there's one in the middle I'm missing there somewhere. Or maybe John Baker was the second. I don't know. I'll have to look that one up.
It'll come to you.
Okay.
Well, Tom Haynes, who's from AOPA and has been a guest on this podcast, he wrote an article in the current issue of AOPA Pilot Magazine. That's the September 2013 issue. And the article is titled The Right Man for the Right Times, and it's all about Craig Fuller. And it kind of came out, you know, at about the same time or pretty close to the same time as the announcement on Craig's replacement. But one of the interesting things in there is that Craig said that he would have some advice. His first advice to the new president would be to get to know the members. And this was the same advice that was given to him by his predecessor, Phil Boyer. So I think that, you know, it's an organization that's sort of, well, all organizations are based on their members, but this is one that I think has a pretty close-knit group of members that really share a lot of things in common. Rob, do you have any projections, or is it too early to talk about what challenges AOPA may be looking ahead, looking at into the future?
Well, I think that the most obvious challenge beyond getting to know the members is what we were just touching on a little while ago about the fact that fewer and fewer people are learning to fly, and membership numbers are down. I mean, they're not down, you know, significantly for AOPA, but they're down. And but of course, too, they're down for most member organizations, for practically any association you can find here in the States. But of course, you know, in order to be able to develop the goodies that all of us AOPA members like, they've got to keep the they've got to keep membership at least level, if not rising. And of course, too, AOPA has been in the midst the last couple of years of some budget crunches, and so I think that, you know, money and members, I think those ought to keep him busy for at least the first couple of weeks.
And members bring money. No members, no money.
That's right.
Well, we'll see if we can get Mark Baker on the show. I'm sure he's going to be pretty busy in these first few months, at least, as he gets settled in and starts to be in the position. Craig, I understand Craig Fuller is not just suddenly disappearing, so I think we're looking forward to a good handoff here, a good overlap of the these two gentlemen, so that that can avoid any transition problems that they might have otherwise. So that's good.
Hey, Max, before we go, can I give a shout out to Errol Cavett tweeted to me when I tweeted the announcement about, and I have to give the guy credit. He really thought that the guy's name should be Martin instead of, so it would be Martin Baker would be a better name for a AOPA president.
Is that right?
As in the ejection seat. So I shout out to Errol on the Martin Baker joke.
Okay, very good. You know, I found myself wondering what Craig is going to be involved in after AOPA, and I discovered that there's something called thefullercompany.com that Craig is has going. I don't know if this is a new organization or something that he's had for a while, but looks like the mission is to provide strategic counsel. Yeah, kind of as on a consulting basis, I guess, to a variety of organizations, I suppose. That sounds like maybe that's Craig's new adventure. Okay, next item comes from Aviation Week. This is titled, Northrop Eyes Really Large Unmanned Airships for Freight. And it's kind of on the topic that, that you'd expect with that title. Northrop has been looking at providing great big airships for the UPS and FedEx type of customer. These are unmanned, so we're back to that. Something that's, I think, been proposed in a number of different areas. Different countries have had some similar ideas. Nothing's really got off the ground, I don't think. Rob, when you worry about unmanned airliners and such, freight's probably the area where most people would like to see that start, because if there is a big issue, if there is an accident, there aren't human beings involved.
Well, that's probably a bit of an inopportune comment this week, maybe since we lost those two UPS guys last week in the Airbus crash at Birmingham.
Yeah.
You know, there's been this controversy going about flight time, duty time rules for Part 121 pilots. And, of course, the FedEx guys, the UPS guys, those are all Part 121 except their cargo. And, of course, they have been exempted from the flight time, duty time rules. And nobody's been real happy about that. And, of course, the FedEx guys, as one of my friends who flies for them said, What are we, chopped liver? You know, and the problem is that there's two of them, and there's 250 of them on a 787, or you know, 300 or whatever it is, and it's a matter of numbers, and it's really kind of scary to think that that's where we are right now. As people are thinking about, well, it's only a cargo airplane, and it's only a couple of people on it. It's no big deal if it goes down somewhere, and it's kind of tough to live with.
But if you were going to move cargo by unmanned airship versus moving passengers by unmanned airship, I mean, cargo seems like it's the area to start out with.
Well, but how fast is this thing?
Yeah, I don't know. There's really very little detail about this particular airship.
Can't be very fast. I mean, with that huge bulk in the air, I mean, you're certainly not going to be doing any FedExing kind of work where it needs to be in a particular place in a short span of time. So, but I guess the good news is that with something that big, at least you'd be able to see it.
Yeah, it would. I would think it would really stand out. You know, looking up at the sky and seeing that big blimp or whatever it's going to be.
Aerostat,
there we go. It sounds much better than blimp or airship, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, the word airship brings to mind large flames crashing over Lakehurst.
Mm. All right. There have been a number of aviation accidents, it seems like, in the past few months. There was another one recently. This comes from Vertical Magazine. A fatal crash grounds offshore Super Pumas. And there was a fatal crash of a Eurocopter, AS-332L2 Super Puma, off the coast of Shetland Island. And four oil workers died in that accident. And the pilot, the co-pilot, and 12 other passengers were rescued. There's an industry group, Step Change in Safety. Their helicopter safety steering group had recommended a temporary suspension of all helicopters in the Super Puma series, and the offshore operators seemed to be complying with that recommendation. But these helicopters, these Pumas, were just recently returning to service, weren't they?
Yeah, they were grounded for quite a few months because the Super Puma, for people that may not know what, it's a big helicopter. You know, at gross weight, I think it's 19 or 20,000 pounds and carries, I think, 20, including the crew. So it's a big monster machine, and they're used a lot in other parts of the world. There are very, very few of them here in North America. I think there's some in Canada, but not really any in the U.S. But they use them a lot out in the North Sea for shuttling oil crews up and back from the oil rigs. And they ran into a couple of problems where they ditched last year. I believe it was last summer that started because they had some gearbox problems. And luckily, there were some injuries, but I mean, no one was killed. But they grounded the Super Pumas for many months, 5, 6, 7 months. I forgot what it is right off the top of my head. But they had just been returned to service as Eurocopter, which... you guys will have to correct me. I think it's now EADS's, EADS helicopters, I believe they call them.
Yeah, which is now renamed to just be simply Airbus. And yeah, they've had some name changes.
Well, anyway, I mean, one of our European guys maybe probably knows that. But they had just returned them to service a couple of weeks ago. And now we have a fatal crash. Four people were killed in this ditching near the Shetland Islands, and so this is the first fatal they've had in a while. But you know, there have been, I think I counted, 8 or 9 crashes of Super Pumas in the last 6 or 7 years. So it doesn't exactly have the most stellar safety record. But now, of course, no one wants to fly in this thing because they don't know that it... Right now, they're struggling. Was it something completely different that caused the total... And they had a total power failure, which is why they ditched in this one, the yesterday. I think it was yesterday or... No, I'm sorry, it was last week, I believe. But...
again, they don't know if it was related to the same gearbox problems that they had last year, or if this is this some other issue. All they know is that nobody's getting in these babies. So EADS's helicopters has got a real problem on its hands.
Yeah, and at the time the article was written, there was practically no information, as you say, Rob, about the cause for this. I guess they have the helicopter, or it's not a case where this thing is just at the bottom of a deep ocean.
No, and I don't think they, at least as of today, I don't know if they had recovered the flight, the cockpit voice recorder and the data recorder, although the two pilots survived. These were the four guys that died were passengers. So they should be able to rebuild the profile here and figure out what in the heck happened in those last few minutes before it went in.
Yep.
And let's face it, that environment is not the best environment in the world for any aircraft, let alone a helicopter.
Oh,
The North Sea environment that those helicopters fly in, that's real rough weather that, you know, can change it at any moment.
Okay, what do you say we jump into some of the listener mail? Maybe we can break this up a little bit, do some now, come back, Wait, no. It's time for David. No, we do David after the... See, I'm all mixed up.
Why? You always do me after the guest.
Yes, but we don't have a guest. That's why I'm mixed up.
So why don't we do some news? Why don't we do some listener mail, our guest, and then we'll come back and do some me, and then we'll come back and do... the show, and then we'll do listener mail at the end of it.
I think that's a great idea, David. First, let's look at an email from Hudson. He said he's a new listener, just started listening a few weeks ago. He says he really enjoys the show. He's based in Romeoville and works in Tinley Park. So he says he has a good amount of time every day on the ride to work to listen to the podcast. He has a question about flight training. Okay, Rob, this is like cue Rob. So he says, I'm a little different than most people in that I don't like to go into debt to do anything. With the exception of my home, I prefer not taking out loans. I had to get another car recently to facilitate my new son. Me and my wife are attacking the debt we had incurred to get a used car. So he says, I was taking flight training in Louisiana before I moved, he says, but living in Illinois isn't cheap. I wanted to know if you could point me in the direction that I can finish my training without incurring debt. Looking forward to hearing from you all. And that's from Hudson. So, I mean, this has got to be a kind of a common question, Rob.
I wish I could say there's a way to do it without debt. And the only way I know of is to have a savings account or to borrow from your parents. But the one issue about learning to fly that people do not often take into account is you don't want to do it. You don't want to schedule your lessons for those times just when you have enough money to do it, because you'll stretch your lessons out over so many years, it will probably cost you three times as much to learn to fly as if you had just gone in debt and borrowed the $8,000 or $10,000and funded your lessons two or three per week and gotten done in 4 or 5 months. So while I do not like to see anybody in debt, although that sounds a little silly for me, having just sent my daughter to college, but you know, there are times where if you are trying to leverage money to produce a better result in the future, that's the kind of debt I think that is worthwhile. Kind of like buying a house. You buy a house because you think it's going to appreciate and that someday you'll sell it for more than you paid for it. That's a good debt. I mean, you know, a car, another story. I mean, it's probably worth less every day you have it. So I think you need to decide how important learning to fly is. If it's just a pastime, you know, you're right. You may just have to live checkbook to checkbook, or I'm sorry, paycheck to paycheck. But if you have any hopes of any kind of a career in flying, I think you're going to need to bite the bullet and borrow the money from someone or someplace in order to get going. Otherwise, again, it's going to cost you three times as much.
Yeah, it's an investment.
Exactly. That's the word I was struggling for. Investment. It's an investment in your future.
And actually, I used to tell that to people that when they learned to fly when they were in their 20s, and they'd say, oh, my gosh, it's so expensive. And I'd say, but look at how long you're going to have your license. Your license doesn't expire, even if you're only a private pilot. All you need to do is keep a current medical, and you can fly for 40 years, 50 years. I mean, you know, divide the amount of money you spent learning to fly by 50, and what do you come up with? Not a whole lot. So, you know, again, it's you really have to think about that, I think.
Yeah. And it's a lot like paying for college, like with your daughter.
You had to bring that up, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right. Another email. We always like it when we make connections. Sometimes it's connections between us and you all, our listeners. And sometimes there's connections between listeners. And so we had an example of that, where Dima, who writes an interesting blog called Dima's Corner, he had an opportunity to meet up with Jesus Calderon and got a little kind of personal tour of the Barcelona Tower and the area around there. And Dima has written that up in his blog. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's kind of fun, and there's a lot of great pictures that he took from his visit. And so we're glad that he was able to get to meet up and to pass along sort of the results of that. All right, you'll recall that a couple episodes ago we had Matt Desch on, the Iridium Satellite CEO, and we got an email about that topic from Jason. Jason said that he noted that during Katrina, for extended period of time, Iridium was the only communications technology that worked in a wide area in the Gulf. He says satellite phones were still in their infancy, and not many people, including first responders, had much experience with them. They weren't pre-positioned in the area where they would be needed like they are today. He said one lesson learned is that having a satellite phone without any training or experience, that's not very helpful. So he says we created Test Your Satellite Phone Week, which is modeled after the Test Your Smoke Detector Battery Week concept. And there's a free number that they provide. This is a U.S. number, so country code 1-480-752-5105. And he says, which when called from any satellite phone, lets the user get experience with their satellite phone at no cost. And the recording gives helpful tips on its operation. So that's fairly useful.
One of the other things he does say that people were doing things like using a satellite phone indoors, and the phone can't find satellites if you're in a building, folks. So it's one of those things you don't realize, but like all safety equipment, you need to train on it, and don't try to learn it the day you need it.
Yeah, for sure. Be prepared. Absolutely. Now, Jason, also, is this the same Jason, David?
No.
This is a different Jason who was wrote in actually kind of a while ago that he was listening to episode 259 with Bill Barry, the NASA chief historian. And he says he mentioned the free publications that are available for free PDF download. And Jason says in a bit of shameless self-promotion, he said he did use a few of those publications for a series that he did. He did a five-part series on the F-8 Crusader digital fly-by-wire program. And it's a pretty comprehensive series, David, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually very good. Both Rob and I have met Jason. He's a airline pilot, and he likes naval aviation, especially if it's got jet engines. And it's a good history, and I think people, if they want to read it in the show, we'll put the links in the show notes. It's a good history of an aircraft that NASA used when they were learning fly-by-wire, and the F-8 Crusader is one of those great naval fighters of all time.
That thing was like a tank, I think, wasn't it?
It was, and it has one of the most unique wings in the world. The fact that the wing could be variable incidence, and it could be raised or lowered, so that when you were approaching the deck of the carrier, the F-8 was always level. The wing was raised, so the wing would provide additional lift, And same thing on takeoff, but the fuselage in the cockpit was level with the carrier.
I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
So we'll have links to each of these parts of the series, all five parts, in the show notes, of course. It's at the Lexicans blog, which at first I, you know, looked at that, thought, what does that mean? Lexican, the Lexicans blog. What does that mean? But actually, David, it turns out that there's kind of a little bit of interesting history associated with that, isn't there?
Oh, I know what they are.
You do?
Yeah, that's those little guys in Ireland that run around that have the pot of gold. The Lexicans?
The Lexicans.
No?
No, this is different in this case, right, David?
There was a very famous naval blogger by Neptunus Lex, which he unfortunately passed. And Jason and a few other people have taken up his mantle, and they call themselves the Lexicans.
So thanks to Jason for passing that series along to us, making us aware of that.
It's not the little Irish guys, huh?
No, this is different.
Okay, sorry. All right.
If you're really interested in history, in aviation history, maybe back almost as far as it can go, Ray Rivera sent us some information about the Da Vinci Codex that's going to be at the Smithsonian. And this is the notebook. This goes back to, it says, roughly 1505 that Leonardo da Vinci wrote. It's got his ideas and sketches about mechanical flight and birds. And it's going to be at the on display at the National Air and Space Museum next month, starting in September. This isn't, David, they're not putting the actual book on display.
Yeah, they are.
Are they?
They're putting the actual book on display.
Ah, but don't they also have like a digitized version? Maybe that's the version that you can actually flip through.
Yes, you can flip through and look at the photographs and all of the drawings. Leonardo da Vinci wanted to fly. The best way to learn to fly is study birds, and that's what these are all his sketches and drawings and notes. So, because he had the goal of making a machine that would fly.
You know, and I think probably everybody has seen these sketches, but if not, you know, you look at these things written back in, 1500, and they just bear a remarkable resemblance to some of the things that you see today. It's almost, it's just kind of amazing.
Yeah, Da Vinci was kind of scary. I mean, the man created things like tanks before. Now, he called it a movable turtle, and he had the giant air screw, which was basically a helicopter as it spun its... And he had manned gliders. So he was a genius ahead of his time. And as a weapons designer and a military, because that's part of his career was weapons design, he was absolutely brilliant. Not only was he a great painter, but he was a good seer, a good person who could observe things and learn and make applications from them.
Wow. Well, the article that Ray sent along notes that this is apparently only the second time this book has made an appearance in America, and it'll be at the museum, the National Air and Space Museum, from September 13th through October 22nd. So I imagine this is at the downtown facility, although check the website to confirm that.
It's at downtown.
Yeah, I would think so. That's a great destination, that museum, and this would be a sort of an extra special reason to go and be able to actually look at what Da Vinci had drawn. Amazing stuff.
Hey, David, when they have a book like that that's 500 years old, they're displaying, I mean, it's in some sort of a hermetically sealed case or something with some sort of atmosphere that keeps the paper from deteriorating, I think, or something, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a climate control. They probably have it open to a specific page in a climate controlled sealed environment, because that at that age the paper is incredibly fragile. So, archive documents, I'd love to give a presentation on, but I don't think everybody wants to be bored by how to preserve 500-year-old books from falling apart, but I do have some experience in doing that. That was part of one of my college studies.
Patrick Wiggins also wrote us again. We've heard from Patrick in the past, I believe, and he mentions a great interview about the Iridium system and its history. We talked about the Iridium flares, and again, this is when there's a reflection, a glint of light off of the Iridium satellite that you can actually see from the surface of the Earth, and they're incredibly bright, and they call those Iridium flares. He said that he's got a source for where you can see when these are happening, and it's called calsky.com, calsky.com. And he says it offers some additional predictors for things like when the International Space Station will be visible, when satellites can be seen crossing in front of the sun or the moon, and even when an aurora might be visible. He says it's really handy. It's a free service, and you can, I guess, configure this so that notices show up in your inbox, your email inbox, when you tell it which your location and what you'd like to be notified of. So that's pretty cool. Thanks, Patrick. Patrick calls himself the NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador to Utah. David, do you know what that's all about?
He calls himself the NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador to Utah. That's all I know.
Okay. So he's got a website, utahastro.info. So you can check out Patrick's website.
What else is there to do in Utah except ski and watch satellites go by?
Oh, yeah. Well, photography. Utah's got some amazing landscape and formations.
And if you like choirs, they've got a really good one.
Yeah, actually, Utah's got quite a lot of stuff to recommend for it. All right. Hey, let's do some of the listener voicemails we heard. You know, last week, David made what I interpreted to be an impassioned plea for people to call into our listener line. And we got a response from that. And the first one comes from...
You sound surprised.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what this is all about. So listen, this is the first one. This is from Launchpad.
Airplane Geeks, this is Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari with a PIREF from Tonkosh 2013. Yes, you heard that correctly, Tonkosh. It's the largest German fly-in here in southern Germany. We have 300 and some planes already on the ground. The Red Bull P-38 Lightning just flew in. It's gorgeous. It's polished. And the other big plane on the ground is a Luftwaffe C-60. Have Dave explain that, what that is for you. But 300 airplanes on the ground. It's a lot of fun here at Tonkosh. Try and get some more reports for you a little later.
So,
that's Brad. That's a guy. I don't know, David, if you remember him, the fellow from Germany that you may have met when you were at Air Venture a couple of years ago. Big tall guy with a big bushy mustache.
Right, and it's the old timer Fliegenhafen Hadwalde Kirchenheim. It's Han, H-A, and Max, I know you were struggling with this. It's H-A-H-N, Han, as in Han, Germany. And they have a fly-in, evidently. Now, on Das Haas und C-160 Transhall, which is a German two-engine transport, kind of somewhere in the class of a C-123 and a little smaller than, for a while there, it was NATO's C-130. It was a Transhall was a German-French cooperation, kind of like Tornadoes and that whole time when everybody was getting together. But Transhall is a two-engined transport, roughly the size of a C-130 that is supposed to be replaced by the A-400.
Oh, all right. Well, I think some of these guys are in cahoots. I'm not sure. Here's the next voicemail. This comes from someone claiming to be John Philip.
Hello, this is John Philip from Germany. We are here at Tonkosh, and it's a great show here. We wish you a great day here from Germany, from Tonkosh, and best greetings from the SAR, Search and Rescue Helicopter from the Luftwaffe. I hope you enjoy. Bye-bye.
Perfect.
Perfect.
So, somehow I got the impression Brad put him up to that.
I think he must
have. Yeah, yeah.
All right, one final of the trio here. This is from Chris.
Hi, Airplane Geeks. I'm Chris. I'm the helicopter pilot from ZH-53. Very, very greetings from Tankhurst 2013. Bye.
So I think maybe Chris was also with the fly-in.
I wonder if he flies a Super Puma.
Probably not these days.
You're right.
Yeah. Thanks for that, guys. If they're calling in from Germany, the listener line, you know, there's a flaw in our little system here, which is that unless you're, well, it's a U.S. number. And so if you're calling into it from the U.S., from your cell phone or something, you might be okay. But calling in internationally, that might incur some charges. So I want to thank the three guys for sending in their comments.
So evidently it does work, but I still don't believe it. So we could use some more.
Okay.
Well, since I wasn't here last week, what did you actually ask, David?
I basically said that I didn't believe our listener line worked, so we needed somebody to call in to prove that it actually functions.
That's right.
Huh.
And we got these three guys did.
And folks, we really do this for the selfish reason, because when you call into our listener line, Google prints a transcript of what it thinks you're saying, which usually is more hysterical than actually your conversation. So for selfish reasons, we like getting phone calls.
That's right. Yeah, please take advantage of that. I think it gives you 3 minutes, and then it cuts you off without warning. So keep that in mind. Also, if you want to record something, an MP3, and email that in or get that to us somehow, that works as well. It'll sound better, but either one is fine. Most phones these days, most modern phones these days, have recording capability, and you can probably do that with what you've got in your hot little hands. All right, hey, why don't we take a little break from the listener mail? And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. Back in episode 254, we discussed the PA-24 Comanche. That was only 8 weeks ago. However, I got a grumble that I needed to do more GA. So, Bill, here's your GA subject, despite the fact that you went to the rival high school. The airplane of the week, the PA-28 Cherokee. The PA-28 Cherokee grew out of Piper wanting to make a less expensive product to compete in the class of the Cessna 172 and Beechcraft Musketeer. The result was a low, constant-chord rectangular wing, called the Hershey Bar because it resembled that other famous Pennsylvania product. The aircraft has an angled wing root where the leading edge sweeps forward, not meeting the fuselage at a right angle. The first flight of the PA-28 was on January 14, 1960. The FAA granted type certification later that year on Halloween. Interesting, the lower-rated 150 didn't receive its certification until June 2, 1961. Officially, production started and deliveries occurred in the latter part of 1961. The original type off the line was either the 28-150 or the 28-160. The dash number represents the horsepower of the Lycoming O-230 engine. The engines were driving a fixed-pitch two-blade propeller. The original Cherokee came with either spatted or unspatted fixed tricycle landing gear. The cockpit can only be entered from the starboard side door. The cockpit was designed for training with dual control yokes and rotor pedals. Tow brakes were an initial option, but eventually became standard. The flaps are manually articulated using a Johnson bar located between the front seats. It operates just like parking brake in a car. No flaps, the bar is flat on the floor. It can then be pulled up for the three flap settings, 10, 25, and 40 degrees. Originally, the Cherokee came with control knobs for the throttle mixture and propeller advance. These were eventually replaced with a throttle quadrant with levers. A third set of windows were added in 1968. The following year, 1962, Piper brought forth the Piper Cherokee 180 featuring the Lycoming O-360 engine developing 180 horses. Additional power made it practical to fly with passengers in all four seats as well as a full fuel load. In 1963, Piper introduced the Cherokee 235, or the PA-28-235. The Lycoming 0540 was derated to 235 horsepower. The wing was changed from 30 feet to 32.8 feet. The longer wing would eventually be used on what would become the Cherokee 6. While the 160 was designed to compete against the 172, the 235 was competition for the heavier Cessna 182. The fuselage was lengthened in 1973 by 5 inches. With that stretch, the stabilator was also increased. Marketing changed the name, and we tend to do that, to the Cherokee Charger. In 1974, marketing again changed the aircraft to the Cherokee Pathfinder. Pathfinder production went from 1974 to 78. The wing was changed in 1978 to a semi-tapered wing. The constant chord is from the wing root to the mid-wing. After that, the point wing tip tapers out to the tip. This led the marketing team to again change the name to the Cherokee Dakota. The Dakota would be purchased with a turbo supercharged Continental TSIO 360 FB developing 200 horses. The Cherokee was also always designed to be a trainer. In 1964, to fill that role, the 28-140 was created. The initial aircraft was shipped with only 2 seats and the rear bench removed. Eventually, the 140 horsepower engine was replaced with 150 horsepower. However, the designation never changed. The 140 stayed in production until 1977, and this was always marketed as the Cherokee Cruiser. In 1967, the PA-28R-180, the Cherokee Arrow, the R stood for retracts. It also featured a constant speed prop. It started with the 180 horsepower Lycoming. However, in 1971, the original optional 1969 IO 360 C1C was made standard with 200 horsepower. With the Arrow, the Cherokee 150-160 were removed from production. In 1972, Piper introduced the Arrow 2 with a 5-inch stretch. To improve stability, it also had the semi-tapered wing and a larger stabilizer. Internal fuel was increased from 50 gallons to 77 gallons. The Arrow 3 featured the 6-cylinder Continental TSIO 360F engine and equipped with a Rage turbocharger and a 3-bladed propeller. Piper, in 1979, decided to radically change the Arrow. They changed the tail to a T-tail. Piper had several other Ts at the time, the Tomahawk being one example. The Arrow 4 flew very different than the conventional tailed aircraft. It had better controlled speed but worse low speed characteristics because the stabilator was out of the prop wash. Only 27 of these were built. Eventually, it was deemed a failure and the conventional tail came back. During several years, between 80 and 1984, the Arrow 4 wasn't even built. Eventually, Piper put the Arrow 3 back in production, ending the Arrow 4. Polly Vacher learned to fly in Australia with her husband Peter in 1994. Polly has made several flights around the world in her Piper Dakota, Golf, Foxtrot, Romeo, Golf, November. Her accomplishments in the Dakota are: she was the first woman to fly solo over the North Pole in a single-engine aircraft, the first woman to fly solo over Antarctica in a single-engine aircraft, the first man or woman to fly around the world solo landing in all 7 continents, 60,000 nautical miles over 357 days. Other trips included a circumnavigation of Australia. She also circumnavigated eastbound around the world. In 1997, she circumnavigated the United States, flying solo across the North Atlantic in both directions. All of these flights were done for charity, and eventually she was awarded the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, thus becoming a dame. The Cherokee was license-built successfully in Latin America. Embraer in Brazil, Chinchul of Argentina, and Inair of Chile. The Cherokee also had a small career in military aviation. Yes, if I can, I will always talk MILAV. Sorry, Bill. The Argentine Coast Guard, the Chilean Air Force, the Colombian Navy, the Finnish Air Force, and the Honduran Air Force, and the Qatari Emiri Air Force all flew the aircraft. Almost 33,000 Cherokees have been built since 1960. In fact, my first flight in a GA aircraft was in a PA-28 as a small little boy, flying from Warrington Airport to PHL to take my father to catch a flight for a conference. It's hard to believe at one point I had to be hoisted on the wing. So, Bill, there's your GA. So until next week, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your historian, signing off.
No, oh, thank you, David. Rob, how many of those aircraft have you flown?
I distinctly remember making a transition from a Cessna 150 to a Cherokee early in my private pilot lessons, and it was very, very different because the Cherokee had a low wing and the Cessna had a high wing, and the picture out the window was very different, and it landed very differently. The speeds were different, and I thought I would never learn to do it. But it was a fun bunch. But I do remember too that the I flew the Cherokee 6 for a while, and the Aero, and most of the twins that Piper had. In fact, I was always wondering, David, do you know why they named them all after Native American tribes?
Because that was Piper's naming convention.
Well, I know. I'm just curious if you ever found out why they did it off of that instead of stars or, you know, something.
Well, but eventually they got politically correct and moved away from it.
Did they? The last thing?
Well, because they, you know, eventually they weren't Cherokees anymore. They were Arrows and Archers and...
Cheyenne. Yeah, that's right. I guess I've come to think of them all as part of the same family. I guess I missed that. But anyway.
Well, that's why I'm a marketer.
Yeah.
All right. At this point in time, we normally have the Australia desk, but as we mentioned, Steve and Grant are off. However, they did send something. Rob, you remember the last time you were with us that you thought Grant said something about a saber chicken?
Oh, that's right. Yes. And he was actually talking about saber chicken, but that's right.
That's right. Saber chicken. But they did send something about the saber chicken. So listen to this, Rob.
Say, Grant, I heard you had a bit of trouble with your saber chicken.
Ah, yeah, mate. I just couldn't get the damn thing to work no matter how much I waved it around.
Well, you know I'm on a diet, mate, so we couldn't have saber chicken, so we had to have a light saber chicken.
Oh, and how would that sound? Mate, that's awesome. But you know, I'm in Australia. I really want a saberoo.
Settle down, McCarran. Settle down.
That, Rob, is the saber chicken.
Oh, God. Well, and for all our listeners out there, in case you ever wondered why I'm picking those guys, because I try to make them sound like they're crazy, I rest my case. Thank you, Steve and Grant.
There we go. All right. Hey, let's listen to Peter Johnson across the pond.
Tim Robinson joins me today, and of course Tim's a co-presenter on Extended, but his real job is the editor of Aerospace International, the Royal Aeronautical Society's magazine. So Tim, welcome back across the pond.
Hi there, Peter, thanks for being on the show.
Tim, I want to talk about the Society, but first, Aerospace International's changed a little bit. Why is that?
Well, it certainly has. We've got it's now just Aerospace. It's now just we've dropped the International. And what's happened is that it was well overdue for an upgrade, a revamp, a facelift. It got a bit sort of tired. So what we decided to do is merge Aerospace International with one of our other magazines. And now what we've got is a combined magazine called Aerospace, just Aerospace. And that's a 60-page bumper monthly magazine that goes out to our members. It's perfect bound. It's kind of got a real sort of quality feel to it. We've upgraded the design. It looks absolutely magnificent. We've got really good sort of reviews and feedback from it. It's still got all the sort of same stuff that you have, but it gives us a lot more sort of flexibility within the design to do what we want. And so, you know, like I say, so far the feedback from the members has been really, really great. You know, they love it. It's now a magazine where it's sort of commensurate with being a member of the Royal Aeronautical Society.
And how about electronic versions? Is it, does it come in an electronic version?
Well, at the moment we've got the we actually put the first version out as a PDF, yep. So you could just sort of like download that for free. Members and non-members could get it. If you're a member, can you can access it via the website. You can get the its electronic version of PDF.
So, Tim, what can we look forward to in this new format?
You know, it's got the same sort of focus as previous Aerospace International. But like I say, we've got a little bit more scope to include things that perhaps sort of, you know, kind of fell between two stools. So, for example, first edition things had we had things on the A350, great piece by Rolls-Royce on sort of the innovation and the sort of technology they're working on, future right. sort of engine technology. In the July edition, we had an interview with Tim Clark from Emirates, head of Emirates. But we also had a thing there on quite an interesting article on air power on Dam Busters. You know, it was Dam Busters anniversary this year. And that was a great article on, you know, did it actually achieve its aim? So we've got stuff like that. We've got interviews with the outgoing chief of the air staff from the UK. Coming up, we've got more things on sort of general aviation, search and rescue coming up, the final sort of hurrah for the VC-10, as well as sort of stuff on base, space flights and launches. You know, we cover everything from general aviation to military to airlines to space. It runs the whole spectrum. And also, obviously, in the magazine, we've got things like, you know, what's going on in the local branches. We've got book reviews, interesting little sort of snippets of society, sort of news and history and things like that as well.
Yeah. Now, the society's pretty far range. I know we've talked in the past about some of the lectures that you run, but some of the branches you've got both in the UK and around the world, they deliver lectures quite regularly, and these are free to everybody to attend, aren't they?
The branches around the world run about sort of 400 lecture evenings a year. And all free to attend, and they have some really, really interesting people come to sort of speak. And you know, you just sort of scanning down the list of lectures every month, and you think, crikey, you know, if only I could get to, you know, Washington branch, or if only I could get to the Sydney branch this week, this would be really interesting. So, you know, I would say if you check our branches, list of branches and divisions on our website, have a look there. If you happen to live, whether you're in the US or whether you're in Australia, New Zealand, or in you know, in the UK, check our list of branches. And if you're in the vicinity and there's a lecture nearby, you know, well worth going to.
Yeah, and there's some fantastic lectures as well that are published on your website, which is aerosociety.com. And there's also some really interesting articles on your blog as well.
Yeah, I mean, what we've got is the blog has sort of evolved alongside the magazines. We cover the air shows on it. But again, that's also a good place to put things where, you know, it's not going to fit in the magazine, but you can put in there, you know, an hour and a half of Captain Eric Winkle Brown giving a lecture at Farnborough.
Yeah.
You know, wow, what an aviator. Or Ken Wallace, and, you know, sort of talking about auto gyros and how he doubled for Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. And well, we've got on the podcast now that it's not a direct competitor to Airplane Geeks or Extended, but we have got the lectures, some of the HQ lectures are recorded, and you can go there and you can catch up and you can download them. And I think that's one of the things that we'll continue to you know, kind of work on in the future is making sure that more of these are available.
I'd highly recommend listening to some of those. But one of the key things that the Royal Aeronautical Society is focused on is careers and promoting aerospace and aviation. And on the Airplane Geeks, on Extended, on Plane Crazy, we always get asked, how do you get into aviation? How can we get into aviation? Now, probably one of the greatest career fairs is going to take place in London in November. And you've got the likes of Airbus and Eads attending that. What else can we look forward to for those individuals looking to get a career in aerospace?
Right, okay, well, the Careers Fair is going to be Careers in Aerospace Live. That's happening in London, as you say, in November. It's free, open to all members and non-members. You can come along. I would get there if you're planning on coming. Get there early. It is a very, very busy day. You've got some of the top aerospace companies there looking for talent. But we do. It's important to also note that, you know, if you aren't there but you still want advice, or you still want to get a leg up on the careers ladder, is we have a careers and education department who you can email, you can phone, you can tweet, you can get in touch with, and they can give you impartial, independent advice on you know, things like sort of CV advice, letter writing, for example, job hunting, for anyone at any stage of their career. So they've got a really good in-depth knowledge of the job market and how that sort of relates, and it's there as a resource for you to use.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd also say is the local branches. If you are near a local branch, whether it's sort of a Singapore branch, the Dubai UEA branch, Washington, Seattle, Toulouse, Hamburg branch, or the branches we got in the UK, you know, Wharton, Bristol branch, you know, why not go along to one of the lecture evenings, make yourself known, introduce yourself. You'd be welcome there with open arms, and you will make good contacts there. You know, networking. There will be people who will be able to sort of steer you in the right direction, give you advice, may know people who know people who know people. And, you know, that's a great way to get involved with the society, and also to get into that sort of plugged into that network where, you know, you've got that extra little bit of knowledge or contacts above everybody else who sort of may not have.
Well, no more excuses. We all know where to go now for our future career moves. Tim, thanks so much for joining us. Where can we follow you online?
Okay, well, the Aero Society, the Royal Aeronautical Society is on www.aerosociety.com, and you can find me on Twitter at @RISTimR.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us again.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, guys, shall we get back into a little bit more of the listener mail?
You mean there's more?
There certainly is. We heard from Micah, our main man. Micah writes, just finished listening to the latest podcast. It was wonderful. Matt Desch was an amazing guest. He thought both the Australia Desk and Across the Pond were particularly good segments this week. The portion of the show, he said, that covered the Huffington Post video about electronic devices. He says, Micah says, I feel, however, that whenever this is discussed, a very important factor about such things is never mentioned. So this is, again, it's on personal electronic device use in airplanes. He says, the big issue about onboard personal electronic devices is distraction, not RF interference. Passengers need to at least be able to pay attention and be alert during takeoffs and landings. This is necessary for personal safety as well as the safety of fellow passengers. Emergency evacuation procedures and times are designed with the idea that passengers are paying attention to their surroundings and not distracted by electronic devices. Says, I would argue that reading is not as immersive as headphones and or video. He says, baggage is stowed, tray tables are locked, and seat backs are up during takeoffs and landings, so in the event of an emergency, nothing blocks passengers from making an exit. Electronic distractions need to be kept at a minimum for the same reason. And then finally, RF interference may have been a concern at some time in the past, and while it cannot be ruled out now, it may not be as big a concern as it once was. My guess is the distraction issue is not discussed or mentioned as a reason for stowing electronic devices, for the same reason that so many states, including Maine, still allow talking on a cell phone while driving or riding a motorcycle without a helmet. People tend to believe even false scientific explanations before they doubt their own perceptions of personal awareness within their environment. So I think that's those are good issues. I think those are very good issues. We've seen, again, several accidents recently where the passengers had to, you know, all evacuate And, you know, as we've said before, seconds can make a difference. And being prepared and knowing what to do and having paid attention to the safety messages can have an effect there. So, I don't know. What do you guys think? Is this a big issue?
Oh, I think it is. And I think that when I see most people on an airplane, in fact, I was just thinking about that when we went out to L.A. the other day. We've had a habit since, I don't know, probably since Nance and I have been married, that when we get into an airplane, I'll look around or she'll look around and say, you know, six rows down that way or five rows this way or whatever, just so that we have some rough idea of which way we're going to go and how far if we have to get out. And the reason I think that I've been so focused on that all the years is not just from having flown for so long, but the fact that the research shows that when there are accidents, it's amazing how many people just sit there. They are, you know, whether it's shock or whatever you call it, they just sit there. And, of course, that's why the flight attendants are there, because they yell and scream and say, you know, get out, let's go, and need someone to get them moving. And so, God help you, that's not the time to say, let's see, where the heck is the door again? Imagine if there's any smoke in the cabin. You'll be clueless, just clueless.
Yeah, lack of situational awareness is a big problem, not just here, but, you know, elsewhere, even, you know, in the office and in hotels. When I'm in a hotel, I always take a look at, when I'm going into the room for the first time, is which direction is the exit? You know, if we have to evacuate the building because of a fire and the place is filled with smoke, I want to know when I walk out my door, assuming the door is, you know, I've touched the door and it's not hot. Do I go right or do I go left? Because it could be filled with smoke and, you know, you're not going to be able to see the exit sign. Same thing in an airplane. You need to be aware of where you are in the plane and where you need to go should something happen. And, you know, I don't know. People, you see the look on their faces when the flight attendants are doing the safety talk. And, you know, the seasoned road warriors don't want to look like they're paying attention, because that would then, you know, kind of dash the image of the seasoned road warrior who knows all this stuff. But it can be very dangerous not to pay attention. So I think that's a great point, Micah. Thanks for bringing that up. I think that's definitely part of the personal electronic device debate, the conversation, whatever it is. But, you know, still, people really want to use their stuff on the plane. You know, I don't think we're ever going to be able to prevent that, are we?
Nope.
All right. Let's see. Coming up, we have Justin. Justin is our favorite airplane geek truck driver, if I recall correctly. David, do you want to take this one?
Yes. Justin is our favorite truck driver. And so I'm parked for the night just north of Fort Worth, Texas, off the western branch of I-35, just south of Texas Motor Speedway. Just across the interstate is Fort Worth Alliance Airport. Shortly after getting parked at the pilot truck stop, ironic, isn't it, I heard a familiar sound and looked up to see an F-16 climbing out overhead. For the next few minutes, it was quite a show as one by one, eight of them roared past, followed a short time later by a T-38 Talon. I was able to catch a couple of quick shots with my phone. They're pretty bad, sorry. So, most people, I'm sure, consider the sound of high-powered military roaring past to be a nuisance, not me. He talks about he grew up on a base with his father being a CB. It was his first time he ever, as he says, seen a T-38 in the wild. Quite a treat to end the day on. So, take it easy. Basically, he also wanted to know why he was seeing so many F-16s flying around Fort Worth Alliance. Well, I responded back, Justin, Lockheed Martin's F-16 plan is at Fort Worth Alliance. The T-38 is just used for testing support. Then we got in sort of an email exchange, and he looked on Google Docs and saw the information. But he asked me another follow-on question, which was, David, something I've always been curious about. Why is it that the F-16 and the F-15E do not carry the F/A designation like the Hornet, when both platforms are equally capable of carrying ground attack missions? That's one of those little things I've always scratched my head over but never found an answer. Well, I gave him the answer probably longer than he was expecting, but believe it or not, At one point, the Air Force, well, first of all, the Air Force doesn't like to admit that it has attack aircraft, with the possible exception of the A-10. But that not politically correct reason is, for a while there, the F-16 was being designated as the FA-16. And one of it was because it carried the GAU 30-millimeter cannon, and they used it in Desert Storm. They did a couple of passes with it, and it was an unmitigated failure. So quickly, the F-16 lost the A designation. The F-15E is a little different. It was always considered a strike platform. That's why it's called the Strike Eagle. Like the F-111, it was designed to replace a different mission than attack. Its strike is a long-range penetration mission. You could also include the F-117 in that. To the U.S. Air Force, the A designator is for ground attack aircraft, either the A-10 or the A-7. The Navy was also replacing the F-4 Phantom in the A-7 with the Hornet, thus the F/A designation. Also, it was supposedly only flying one mission or the other. Eventually, they figured out it could carry an air-to-air attacks as well as ground attacks. But, however, if you follow Super Hornet, it's hardly ever called the F/A-18E/F. That's way too many letters and numbers. It's usually the F-18E or F-18F. And also, for a while, the other thing you need to know is, for a while, the Air Force was toying with the designation of the Raptor to be the FA-22A.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
And that was quickly dropped because fighter jocks do not like to admit they carry bombs. So
so is that really the only reason? I mean, no change in mission, just sort of the perception?
No, it's the perception. And the other part about it is the F-18 now is capable, the F-22 is capable of dropping bombs. It's just the Air Force just doesn't like the A designation and never really has. Lastly, and if you notice, we've never called it the F/A-35. It's the F-35 in any of its variants. You would think that actually the Marine Corps version and the Navy versions would be the F/A-35, but no one seems to call it that. So I think that the slash designation has gone to the winds. And even the mighty Tomcat became a precision bomber, but there was no way in hell the Navy or F-14 pilots were ever going to call it the FA-14D. So the A is sort of one of those politically correct, and when they want to show multi-roles to Congress, the Pentagon's not besides themselves to play games with designations. Some of the old ones are the F-84G and the F-84F. The F-84F was basically a brand new airplane, but if they called it an F-84, Congress would approve for it because they weren't paying for a new airplane. They've done that in the past several times with various other aircraft for political reasons. So the F-86D, the Sabre Dog, is a different airplane than the F-86. So it's the fought in Korea. But since they used the same designator, Congress sort of wrote the check for it. So FA is just, no, I've never gotten used to calling it that.
So it sounds kind of like the situation is that the designation doesn't really have any, I don't know, any real functional or practical value. It's just sort of conventions are established and used or misused, as it were, so that different kind of, you know, political objectives can be met.
And these days, no aircraft is not going to drop bombs. I mean, originally the A's were the attack aircraft, the ground attack aircraft, like the A-6 Intruder was a consummate. It wasn't a bomber. It was an attack aircraft. These days, airplanes are fighters and bombers. They're not one or the other. We have multi-role aircraft. And the advent of the multi-role aircraft, you get rid of... They're not bombers. They're clearly not B-52s, B-1s, B-2s. And so it's basically you have fighters now and you have bombers. And the fighters also carry bombs.
All right. Oh, so yeah, that was a lot of information, David. Thanks. We heard from the judge, Arthur Rosen. Rob, did you have a chance to look at that? Arthur wrote, listening to 261 on my walk this morning. He says the 1,500-hour rule is a debacle. I believe we discussed this on your show, which is true. Enclosed is one of two columns I wrote. Column is titled Sully is Wrong, which is sort of a, I mean, Sully is, you know, one of America's heroes. And here's Arthur saying Sully is wrong. So what is he talking about? Just in part, he says Sully's all-encompassing proposition that every first officer should have 1,500 hours and an ATP rating. This is where I disagree with his proposal. To build hours, one can become a certified flight instructor or tow banners to arrive at 1,500 hours of time. My problem with this program, which Congress has told the FAA to enact by August 2013, is that the above type of flying does not give the pilot real-world experience. The exceptions to this rule are a 750-hour requirement for pilots who flew in the service and a 1,000-hour requirement for those flying at an accredited university program. CFIs are also having trouble billing hours because of the limited student starts. So that's just a sort of a sample from Arthur's column. Rob, sounds pretty well-reasoned, doesn't it?
I couldn't disagree with the thing the judge said. It's the same thing most of us have been talking about in the industry since that whole piece of legislation came to be, which was after the Colgan accident. 1,500 hours of flight time doesn't mean diddly. It's all about what you did in order to get that 1,500 hours. And as we said at the beginning of the show, we're having enough trouble finding people to fly now as it is. And yep. This is just going to drive one more nail in the coffin. There are already regional airlines that are canceling flights because they don't have enough pilots to fly the airplanes. Hmm. And it's only going to get worse. I mean, maybe not in the next week, but another year, I'll bet we'll have a whole different perspective on this.
So what's a good solution? I mean, Arthur proposes one, I think, in his article here. He says he'd like to see airlines enact a program where they hire and train pilots to fly. They would require 500 hours in a simulator where all situations could be taught to students with no fear of crashing an airplane. Is 500 hours in the sim a magic number? I don't know, he says. These students could also have 250 hours of actual flying cross-country to go along with their sim time. So, I mean, should the airlines train pilots? Is that where the experience should be developed? Or, I don't know, do you have any other proposed solutions, Rob?
Well, I don't think that telling the airlines to train them is the solution. It is a solution. And I think that very soon, unless someone solves this problem, the magic bullet, which is that, you know, the major airlines, the Uniteds, the Deltas, let's see who's left, Southwest, U.S. Air, well, they're going to be gone. Well, maybe they'll be gone, but we don't know. But they probably are not going to have trouble finding pilots for a while. But eventually, if you kill off that goose of young people that are interested enough to fly regional airplanes for low wages to build time, and you get rid of those because they don't have a way to get to the 1,500 hours to get that first job, eventually the majors are going to have trouble finding people to replace the ones that either retire or pass on or what have you. So, you know, this all feeds into the same problem that we were talking about earlier with the new AOPA president, the fact that they're trying to get more people interested in learning to fly. And it's not just a one-issue problem. I mean, there are many facets to this. But again, they're going to have to figure out some way to get these young people the experience now that they need 1,500 hours. And no one, well, I shouldn't say no one, a couple of schools have proposed a couple of flying solutions, but they're horribly expensive. Because the schools can't afford to give this time away. Somebody has to pay for the fuel and the insurance and the upkeep on the airplanes to get these guys to their flight time. And when people say, I can't afford a $250,000 student loan for any kind of a flying job, nobody's talking about that.
Wow. I don't know where this is going to go. It's sort of hard to tell.
Yeah, it ain't pretty. It ain't pretty at all.
But we'll be talking about it forever.
I hope not forever, but for a long time, certainly. My goodness. Well, let's see. We had an airline-related email from Andy Brown. This is concerning Ryanair. Now, Ryanair is always good for, well, there's always something going on at Ryanair. Maybe there's something always going on with O'Leary. But this is about a documentary on the UK's Channel 4 Dispatches program. And Andy sent a link to that, which, since we're in the U.S., doesn't work here because the Brits have some kind of, well, if you're out of the country, you can't view it. And so, but if you do look around, if you sort of search for the right keywords on YouTube, you can find some bootleg versions of this story. And in this program, they talk about some pilots who have some issues with Ryanair, and one of them being this issue of amount of fuel on the airplane and about being under pressure to, I guess, restrict the amount of fuel, I guess because that costs money and you got to carry it around, and so that's weight, so forth. And allegedly there being some close calls. Some Ryanair flights have come in kind of extremely low on fuel and even had to declare an emergency because of that. You know, my question that I asked some folks, including Peter, is, so what's the Channel 4 Dispatches program reputation? You know, are these guys just kind of trying to stir up something, or do they have some journalistic integrity that cause you to kind of consider this very carefully? And kind of the word I got back was that Channel 4 is usually pretty good at these things. But the accusations are of culture in Ryanair of bullying and suppressing information, which, I mean, if that's really what's happening, I mean, that's a big problem.
Yeah, but is anybody really surprised? I mean, that's the way O'Leary runs his airline? I mean, that's kind of the person that he is.
Yeah, it does feel that way.
Oh, sure. I mean, he likes publicity. He likes publicity for trying some of the wildest things that go on in aviation. But the bottom line is that, as Peter mentioned in one of those email exchanges we had this last week, there are a lot of people that fly them because Ryanair goes to places that nobody else does, and they're cheap. And people say, well, I really need to be there, so they're the only game in town, so what am I going to do? But I think the real issue for O'Leary is that this documentary was kind of instigated by, right now, Ryanair is a non-union airline, and this documentary was instigated by, oh, maybe half the pilot population that are in favor of unionizing Ryanair. And of course, O'Leary doesn't want that at all. If there was ever a guy that didn't want to take orders from anybody, it's him. So, you know, he's come down pretty hard on them. And of course, the actual safety aspect of this issue kind of gets lost in the haze. I mean, and for people that may not understand that, they're, you know, Ryanair makes pilots justify taking more fuel than the dispatcher says they need in order to complete the flight. They do it. It's all computerized. The flight planning's all done with a computer. It looks at the weather, the winds, and it says, okay, for this trip, you need, 10,000 pounds of fuel on board. And the captain might look and say, yeah, however, there's a big weather front out in this area that may impact us. And if that happens, we could really be in some deep trouble here. I want an extra 2,000 pounds of fuel. And Ryanair makes them write a report that justifies why they need it. And so, you know, the senior guys don't care. They just say, hey, look, you know, I'll sign whatever you want. I want the fuel. But the younger guys are, you know, much more reluctant to cross management because they like their jobs. And of course, something that I thought was really interesting that I didn't even know until we started chatting about this week is that a lot of the Ryanair pilots are contract pilots, so they only get paid if they fly. So does it meet the letter of the law? Oh, sure it does. Does it meet the spirit of the EASA regulations? know, it's a little running pretty close to the edge there. And I think everybody knows that Ryanair has done that. But they always say the same thing. Hey, they've never had an accident, so it can't be that bad, right? I mean, so that's kind of what that's all about.
So normally the captain, right, has sort of ultimate control and power over things like how much fuel are we going to put in this bird, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They tried this at American a couple of years ago where they started riding herd on them and telling them how much fuel to put on and making their life difficult if they ordered more fuel. Because as you said earlier, more fuel costs, it adds weight and it costs fuel to carry fuel. So you don't want to take any more than you need. But no captain is going to put more fuel on than they need unless they think they need it. They just don't do that. But I think that the pilots at American made everybody's life so miserable when they started coming down on them that they finally gave in and just said, okay, maybe we'll let the pilots have more of a say in this. O'Leary's not going to do that.
Wow. I think there's also something in this program about the black box data being erased kind of quickly, although I don't really have too much background on that.
Yeah, they did kind of mention that. You know, they said that there was a procedure in the ops manual, the operations manual for all the Ryanair pilots, that if there is ever an incident, I'm not quite sure exactly what the technical procedure is within the cockpit to save the data, but they want to make sure that it does not get erased, either the cockpit voice recorder or the flight data recorder. But they said that mysteriously in a lot of these incidents, none of which anybody got hurt in, but sure scared them a lot, the data mysteriously disappeared, and no one knows how that happened. So it's starting to look a little crazy over there.
Yeah, and I don't know what the status of it is now, but there was subsequently an article in the Telegraph that said that Ryanair fired one of the pilots, voiced his, or at least made some comments on this program, and there's...
And now they're going to sue him.
I think they're going to sue him, or they're talking about it. He's not saying anything because, at least at the time of this article, I guess, because he needs to talk to his lawyer first. But it also mentions that this particular individual, it says he has been involved in legal disputes with Ryanair management in the past over issues related to union representation for pilots. So it's, I don't know what all the motivations here are for the actions people are taking and what they're saying, but it sounds like it's... there's some other issues going on here.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think this one's going to backfire on him. If they sue this guy, I think they're going to get more publicity for this than they wanted in the first place.
Yeah, because this is different than, we're going to charge you a pound or 4 pounds or whatever it was to use the loo. Those kind of publicity stunts, I'll call them, that O'Leary is famous for. I mean, that's one thing. There's no one's getting hurt. They're just getting lots of publicity and generating buzz one way or the other about the airline. But this is different. This is about people, and it's about safety. And yeah, I think you're right, Rob. If they lose control of this, this could really bite Ryanair in the rear end.
Well, and the way that show ended was something to the effect that all the issues that they portrayed or explained in the documentary are things that airline passengers that fly Ryanair should be asking. So whether they will or not is a whole other issue.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating little story there. It'll be fun to see how that plays out. All right, we can close out with an email from Roger. Roger says he's an avid listener, and he was wondering if we can help him with any information concerning his early years of air travel from the UK to Accra in Ghana in the late 50s and 60s. He said his father and mother, now deceased, worked in Ghana. And as a young boy, he traveled to see them three or four times a year, sometimes as an unaccompanied minor. He says, from what I can remember, the first plane was a BOAC Stratocruiser. He says, did they have center pillars in the middle of the fuselage? He says, I don't know where it stopped on the way. Then a Vickers, a Viscount, which used to follow the coast of Africa, calling at many airports on the way. I think we used to stop off at the island off Las Palmas for an overnight stay. Then a BAC 111 run by Caledonia Airlines. The latter days were direct flights by Ghana Airways VC-10. Don't know if you can dig up any info for me, but anything would be appreciated. Boy, all this stuff really predates me, Rob. I don't know if you or David have any kind of information, anything interesting to say about those.
Well, I can identify the airplanes. I mean, I can tell what's a Viscount and what's a VC-10 and a lot of those, the Mach 111 and all those kinds of things. But as far as the inner workings, the goodies, the details, that's David's.
Yeah, I could write a history on all of these, but I'm going to throw this to our extended group over in the UK, since they're all British aircraft, with the exception of the Stratocruiser. That's good old Boeing. But the Viscount and the 111 and the VC-10, that's, Peter, all of your favorite aircraft. So maybe you can dig up some stuff for Roger.
All right. So we'll shift it across the pond a little bit, guys.
And now we take you direct to the extended show thing in the UK.
There we go.
Okay.
We
go.
But Max, before we go on to the next and our closing, you missed an important part of Andy's email.
I did.
You did.
And what was that?
His P.S.
Ah, yes.
It was P.S. I've recently been listening to some podcasts on different subjects, and I was genuinely shocked at the difference in quality. I don't produce anything myself, so I don't mock or hold to an account, but I have to observe that some of the podcasts were terribly produced. One even began with a jangly theme tune and audio effects, then launched straight into a chatty conversation with no introduction as to who was anyone, apart from the host, and some of the participants could barely be heard, etc. I mention this because it really brought me home how just professional your podcast is and that of PCDU. So, thanks, Andy. We all owe it to Max.
Well, I think it's more than that. But thank you very much. We do try to, we do take a lot of pride in the quality of what we produce, and we do try really hard to keep it high production values. Sometimes we have some significant challenges. We've had some issues with Skype. Of course, there's the annual August Chicago cicadas that we have to contend with. But Rob, you seem to have a sort of a small crop of them this year.
Yes, well, that's because I've been out. I tried to go out on Monday evenings and just beat them up before the show. So
yeah, it didn't seem as bad this year. So yeah, we do try. It's a lot of work. It can be frustrating at times, and especially when we run into difficulties. But we all think it's worth it. And so that's what we try to do. So, yeah, thanks, Andy, for mentioning that. Sometimes we'll get comments from listeners about sort of inside jokes. We've had a couple of comments, not recently, but we've had some in the past about that. One of the things that's hard for us to do, guys, at least I think it's hard, is to, you know, we're doing this every week, and we've been doing it for a lot of weeks. And it's sometimes hard for us to kind of imagine what it sounds like to particularly a new listener who's coming in and, you know, doesn't know all the characters, right? We talk about Court, or we talk about Dan, or, you know, there's references to other things that have happened in the past. And
The tankers,
right? There's another one. Hopefully there's not too much of that, because, yeah, I mean, there's nothing more annoying than listening to somebody talking about something or some people talking about something, and you don't know what the background is. So hopefully we don't do too much of that. But, you know, if we do, call us on it. And if if you hear us say something and you don't know what that's all about, you know, write us and say, hey, you know, explain that, because we don't get it. And we'll be happy to. So
call our listener hotline.
There you go, because we know it works now.
Yeah. I mean, and we got rid of that thing at the end that if you talk too long, it takes you directly to the eHarmony site. We got rid of that, right? Okay, so it's not the dating site anymore. Fine. Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
All right, gentlemen, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is episode 263. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com, or if you want to go straight to that episode, just go to airplanegeeks.com/263. And we really want to thank you all for listening. We want to thank our contributors, Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com and Peter Johnson from aviation-extended.co.uk, with, of course, no leading E on extended. Those guys produce some really good quality work as well on their respective podcasts. So if you haven't listened, you know, even if you're not from that region, these guys talk about a lot of stuff that's not always region specific. And, you know, when it is, it's typically fairly interesting. So hopefully that you guys will support them.
As long as you can understand those guys, you know.
Yeah.
Saber Chicken. I mean, what kind of a show is that?
Really?
You know, that actually sounds like an animated, and now for the adventures of Saber Chicken.
Yeah.
And then we get out. Yeah, okay, well.
All right.
Oh, my God.
All right, before we get out of control, so let's tell folks where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on the Airplane Geeks Facebook page and our Google Plus accounts. Just search Airplane Geeks. It'll all come up.
Great. And Rob Mark, there must be one or two places where people can find you online.
Yes, jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine on Facebook, hanging out at various airport social media pages with David and Scott, and I don't know where else. Who knows? Sometimes on Google, an airplane going to Los Angeles. Google? Yeah, there you go. Right.
Google Jetwine. You'll get the Rob Mark Empire.
That's right. That's right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus. Just look for Max Flight. You can also stream us, if you like, to your mobile device from Stitcher.com and also from TuneIn.com. And guys, I don't know if you know this, but there's a lot of automobiles, at least in the U.S., that come with those sorts of systems built in, so you can actually stream us just driving around in your car. Look for us on Stitcher and TuneIn. If you'd like to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, our lovely Aunt Benet can give you the number for the listener line.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody. Can I talk about being a parent who has a child that has flown the coop? Oh, no, we already talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
I'm empty nester now.
Yeah, she's probably greatly relieved, Rob.
Yeah, you know, it's surprising how unconcerned she seems to be about the whole thing. I'm not quite, I haven't figured that all out yet. May I answer?
Yeah, please do.
Oh, wait, I had my... something funny, and it just backfired. But anyway, well, you know, I did see that, and I wish I could tell him that there is a way to do it without incurring debt. And there is, actually. It's called a savings account. But if you don't have the savings... what the heck is that?
What the hell was that?
Did I do that? I wonder. I hope I didn't do that. Oh, maybe I did. I'm, gosh, I am so sorry. fix that, Max.
That's got to be Simba.
That was Simba.
I was hoping you guys couldn't hear that. I didn't mute the mic, and for the one, he decided he was going to have a little scratch there. So,
but that's great. I want to see some photos, guys, from this event. Send us some photos. In fact, if you can send them, well, actually, no, they couldn't send them to us in time for this post. Yeah, that would be tough.
Okay, that one's going on the blooper reel.
Oh. I do need some photos for this episode, so we'll see what we come up with.